Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
When you hear yet another example of people being cruel and heartless to others online, do you ask yourself, how can anyone have so little consideration for another person's feelings? This is your host, Dr. J, and as an experimental psychologist, I like to think about how the electronic networking and connectedness that is so much a part of our life now might be affecting us. One thing we're discovering is how online behavior often reveals a lack of empathy and compassion. Today, you'll be joining me and Jim Nico as we visit with a professor of folklore to learn more about how to read with children in a way that fosters reflection and consideration of how other people might feel. Dr. Maria Tatar is the John L. Loeb Professor of Germanic Languages and Literatures and of Folklore and Mythology at Harvard University. She's been kind enough to join us again today. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Tatar.
Great to be here with you.
Welcome back. I guess I'm going to be serious now.
All right.
Well, first of all, question about like the whole reading scenario. We were talking, you mentioned something about reading on a Kindle versus reading on print. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yeah, well, evidently paper readers are actually better at reconstructing events, reconstructing plots in the stories that they read. There's an article about this in the Guardian, and the researchers went into it expecting that the paper readers would actually have increased levels of empathy, but that turned out not to be the case. It was mainly had to do with the differences in being able to construct a timeline for the events in the story.
Fascinating. So do you have some kind of a intuitive sense of this whole electronic reading as opposed to print? Do you have reflections on that?
Well, I thought the great news was that it doesn't really matter all that much whether we read on a Kindle or in print. That is, the same levels of identification with characters, sort of feeling empathy for those who are in crisis or who are traumatized are pretty much the same. So that's the good news. That said, of course, I keep trying to use the Kindle and sometimes successfully on an airplane, but I still, for the deep read, for immersion, Jim, for what you described to me is that time when you're just sitting on the floor reading. You are completely lost. You are unaware of your environment. You are unaware of the possible pain you're causing to your body, even by sitting in these awkward, contorted positions. You're just in there. You're in the print book.
I wonder if, as people grow up with the electronic reading, that if your mom or dad reads you your bedtime story off a Kindle, that will be part of your overall remembrance of that good time feeling and connection with literature, because it's really hard for me to imagine separating out that history, you know, the fact that I grew up with the print book. Wouldn't that have to make a difference?
Oh, and I think what I mourn is the loss of the artifact. Those books from childhood that we actually do keep, and you know, in some cases, read with our own children. So that seems to me a really important part of the childhood reading experience, and I think I've mentioned at some point to you how, you know, my students bring some of their childhood books with them to college. They occupy a space on the bookshelf with their textbooks from chemistry or economics. So there is a loss there, I think, for sure.
Well, it would make a difference in how you connected, in a sense that, for me, I'm a bibliophile, but and I really like the artifact aspect. There's some books that I've received recently that were printed very recently that just have a marvelous feel to the cover. It's just slightly a nap feeling, and the page is a certain color of white. And you know, I've always really felt connected to books because of those types of aspects. And I'm curious as to whether the digital natives feel that. I hope someone in that category will comment on our blog and discuss this with us.
All of those haptic or sensory components to the reading experience are missing on any kind of screen. Maury Sendak used to talk about the taste of books, and he would always first try them out by biting them, biting and smelling.
He wrote what are his famous books?
Where the Wild Things Are,
and
the wonderful In the Night Kitchen, so on and so forth.
Right.
There, he's just the best. And I think at one point he even talked about sleeping with his books. And certainly in a more innocent vein, there are plenty of kids who put books under their pillows, important books under their pillows.
As we talk about and with our listeners, fans, whatever they may be called these days, it's interesting when I say that we are featuring and trying to promote women's empowerment, and they ask about examples, and I talk about these series that we're having with these brilliant women, innovative women around the world. One thing that comes up is, like, it's interesting to me when I bring your name up and what you do. These young parents or middle-aged parents or whatever, they immediately light up. I say, well, we talk about reading for kids and why it's important, especially in this age and stuff. So, they say, oh, I want to listen to those shows. I want to listen to those shows. So I wonder what it is that all of a sudden, I mean, reading is such a simple thing, but why are they so tuned in? Why do you have any sense of why they might want to listen to someone talk about reading to their kids? And, you know,
I think we have more need today than ever for that contact zone, that sort of quiet space, uninterrupted by bells and whistles, away from the rush of things. It seems to me no accident that Peter Pan, which is really the inaugural book about bedtime reading. You know, parents weren't really reading to their children in the 17th century. They didn't. They had them say their prayers, or they just put them to bed summarily. So it seems to me, you know, Peter Pan is coming back, I think, in part because we recognize the importance of those nighttime stories, those reassuring tales that don't necessarily put you to sleep, but make you curious about what's going to happen tomorrow, what could happen tomorrow. That is, they really promote that sort of curiosity about the world and what is out there.
Oh, thank you. And by the way, if you were going to read, if you were a parent, is there maybe an array of books, your top choices for kids, let's say, oh, I don't know, even the age group, I would say maybe like, what, 5 or 3 or 4 up on up. Do you have, what would you start with if you were doing that over again?
Well, of course, you have to start with Goodnight Moon. That is obligatory reading, and you have to read it at least 500 times before going on to, you know, Dr. Seuss, The Cat in the Hat. You know, an amazing book, like much of what he wrote, wonderfully deep. And I never tire of looking at the illustrations and analyzing it and interpret it. It becomes a different story each time I read it. And then, you know, as far as picture books go, Sendak, of course, you know, Where the Wild Things Are. And actually, my favorite in his trilogy, the third one is Outside Over There, is In the Night Kitchen, which is just an extraordinary story about all the anxieties you feel before you're going to sleep and how fantasy and stories have the ability to reassure you, to make you feel safe, to make you feel that, yes, there will be breakfast tomorrow on the table, there will be cake, and maybe you even had a part in creating it. So, yeah, those are just a few. I love the classics. Ferdinand, what doesn't get better than that? So that said, there are so many great new authors, illustrators, John Sheetska being one of my favorites.
Thank you very much. And is it the number one, I would say, benefit, or is there a number one benefit from reading to these kids before they go to bed? Would you say there's one or more than one? I mean, what is the most fascinating to you, you think?
Well, to me, if I can come back to the idea of curiosity, arousing curiosity, animating us, making us feel alive. And here I would recommend Ron Suskind's wonderful book, Life Animated, about how he awakened his autistic son through stories, through Disney films in that case. Nabokov, and if I can, I know, Jim, you were a fan with me, writes in Lolita about incuriosity. And a philosopher named Richard Rorty took that a step farther and talked about the greatest peril to us is becoming monsters of incuriosity. That is, failing to engage, get in touch, you know, to be there, to feel your own pain and the pain of others. And so much of that can be done, can be awakened through stories.
Thanks. We're going to go on to our next segment now. I'm Jane Karwoski, along with Jim Nico, and you're listening to The Social Network Show as we speak with Dr. Maria Tatar of Harvard University's Department of Folklore and Mythology.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Carlos, you getting ready for bed?
In a minute, Dad. I'm studying.
Well, it's good he's doing his homework.
Something we should be doing.
What do you mean?
You know that guy who called a few days ago from a so-called mortgage rescue company?
Yeah.
He mailed us all these papers to sign.
Think we should?
I heard that many of these people who claim they can save homes from foreclosure are not legitimate, and that we should do our homework, not rush into this. Look, I know we're behind in our payments, but the last thing we need is to be scammed.
A wise decision. McGruff the Crime Dog here. Beware of companies that promise to save your home from foreclosure. It only takes a little time to become informed. Start by finding a free legitimate housing counselor today.
Take the first step. Visit www.ncpc.org/mortgagefraud. That's ncpc.org/mortgagefraud. This message is from the National Crime Prevention Council and U.S. Department of Justice.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, where we're talking with Maria Tatar of Harvard University about reading to children and the benefits thereof. Maria, I have a question, though. What about stories that are maybe not happily ever after type of stories? They're scary. Do you have an example of that that you think is still beneficial?
Yes, you know, today children are reading stories that are dystopias, places that we don't want to go to elsewhere, someplace that can be deeply frightening. I'm thinking here of Lois Lowry's The Giver, which really started it all, came long before The Hunger Games and other series. And I want to read just the beginning of that to give you a sense of this book. So important and engaging. It was almost December, and Jonas was beginning to be frightened. No, wrong word, Jonas thought. Frightened meant that deep, sickening feeling of something terrible about to happen. Frightened was the way he had felt a year ago when an unidentified aircraft had overflown the community twice. At first, he had been only fascinated. And there, I think what is so important is that frightened and fascinating, the yoking of those two, that is, you know, what terrifies us also fascinates us. And then I love the way that Lois Lowry in this book, the second word, no, and then the next sentence, wrong word, drawing attention right away to the whole question of how do you say things, how do you express how you feel? The importance of language right up front and center. How do you express something that really scares you, that, you know, makes you feel that you can't navigate a situation? So these are, you know, these are books that give us all the perils and possibilities. And, you know, in the case of The Giver, it's interesting you talked about Happily Ever After, and there it is. Without giving anything away, there is a certain ambiguity to the ending.
Okay. To where it could be interpreted as things are going to be all right after all.
We hope so, yeah. but I'm not going to give you 100% certainty
okay.
or security.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that reminds me of a book that I read once where people were sort of trapped in a basement due to an earthquake, I think it was, and the story ended without your knowing whether they got rescued or not. And there was tremendous hue and cry about what a horrible ending. And I'm thinking, well, you know, that's ridiculous, because this way you can make it anything you want.
You can co-create, yeah. But you might also end up reenacting it constantly, which is, you know, we actually know very little about the after effects of some of these stories.
Mm. Interesting. So the idea then for reading to kids, you talked about the curiosity, the in some ways anticipating that there will be cake tomorrow, there will be food on the table. So there's, in essence, a sense of that's enkindled, no pun intended, of hope about tomorrow. And so I would imagine, I don't have any stats on this, but kids that are read to that are engaging their imaginations probably dream more vividly, or maybe not. I wonder if that ever plays a role, you know?
Oh, I'll bet. And actually, I like your pun. That is kindle. Kindle fire. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why we put these names on new technologies. You know, isn't it Baldwin who said, you know, we have to have stories. They're the only light in the darkness. Mm-hmm. They are what, you know, animate us, as I said earlier, illuminate things for us, enlighten, help us know about what is going on out there. And, you know, they have beauty also. They not only kindle our imaginations, well, they kindle our imaginations because they contain so many beautiful things, along with the horror, which, as I said, fascinates us, and that we have to deal with at one time or another in real life. So what better way to prepare us for that than to work through it in a symbolic story?
Well, so there's a story And it's a sort of a chronicle of something with Jack London that shocked me. And what it was he was actually talking about writing. And he was reflecting back on when he was in Alaska, and you right away get that feeling of ice and snow and the barrenness of it all. But he told this, and I'd really love to get your opinion. He said basically that fiction and nonfiction have a tremendous difference. And here's how he put it. He said, I had a story that really happened around the campfire, and I put that into story form. I wrote it out. I gave it to people. They didn't resonate. No matter how many times he told true stories, they did not get into what he wrote. But when he imagined something completely imaginary, something that he made up in his own mind, people would relate. So I have my reasons why it kind of shocked and fascinated me. What do you think of that, Maria?
Well, it's extraordinary. And all I can think of is the phrase true lies. That is, you know, you often have the higher truths mediated through lying. African-American folklore, everywhere you find that the stories are referred to as lies. And, you know, these misrepresentations. But, you know, somehow you have to, for a story to catch you, you have to go beyond reality in a way. And I'll have to look up, is that an essay by Jack London?
Yeah, I'll get that to you, actually.
Yeah,
But what could that possibly mean? I mean, in essence, he said it didn't matter. I'm embellishing a little, but it did not matter how outrageous the story was.
Yes. Well, as somebody who works with fairy tales all the time, where, you know, everything is blown up. And exaggerated, and, you know, blown up in both senses of the term. Yeah. And it's all about excess and larger than life, not always twice as natural, sometimes twice as unnatural. And so, you know, we are riveted when we see those things or read about those things and see them in our mind's eye. That is, we read precisely to get away from dull, ordinary reality and, you know, to be taken away in a sense.
Well, there's a fascination to history for me, though, that when I read about, to put how bad things were in the past, and yet here we still are. To me, it's very encouraging,
right.
And especially like I was reading Bowling Alone, which is almost 15 years old now, but it's the examples he gives of around the 1900s, the turn of that century, the from 1890 and to 1910, the impact of immigration in the United States, and that in 18 out of 20 of the cities over 100,000 in population in the country, in the United States, 18 of them had more than half of the people, the workers, were foreign-born. Less than half were born in the United States. And I'm thinking, you know, look at the panic that exists in some areas today about immigration. And I know I'm going way off the theme of fiction, but there's a case where nonfiction can be very, to me, very comforting.
Oh, and I think that what you bring up is important because immigrants, of course, are our other. They represent alterity, everything that we're not somehow. You know?
Mm-hmm.
No matter where they're from, we sort of project onto them the uncivilized parts of ourselves.
Mm.
And that's actually where I think reading becomes really important, because you read about other people, people who are not like you.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you discover? Oh, you know, actually
like
the
us.
Way that they think, the way that their minds work, mm-hmm. is very much the way that my mind works. And I can empathize with this person. And, you know, the psychologists have shown, actually, that reading does have that power. It enables us to start to empathize with people who are different from us. I don't know how long that effect lasts, and I don't think they've determined that either. But I have a hunch you know, from my own childhood reading experience, that it continues throughout your life. That is, there is something about that, being able to get inside somebody else's head, have them get under your skin in a way, makes a real difference.
We talked about, if I may, the what parents might read to their kids. You gave a beautiful array of books. Is there anything to the idea that how long, I mean, in this busy, overworked world, I can imagine a parent saying, a step parent, a grandfather, grandmother saying, you know, I don't have a lot of time here. It's probably not worth it to start a story. But is there anything about duration? I mean, just 5 minutes of reading?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, if you go on Amazon, you'll find that there are all these books called 1 minute bedtime stories. You know, for the busy parent, there's a whole array of these. I would say, you know, there's a way in which the short story with a punchline can deliver a great hit. So I'm all for that, short and sweet and interesting. But I also think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with interrupting a story. Think of Scheherazade telling the Arabian, you know, she stops. she keeps alive the curiosity of the king each night. So, of course, kids are going to be less patient than the king was, and they may want to know what happens. But I think that, you know, there's if a parent decides, oh, let's take, I read Les Miserables with my son when he was, but he somehow had decided that he just wanted to read this 1,200-page book. So we slogged through it and, you know, had a lot of fun, and there was, it worked.
How
and
old
so
was
I'm
he?
All for the whole range of things.
How old was your son at that time?
Oh, gosh, I think he was going into fifth grade, which would make him about 10 or 11.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always a delight to talk with you, Dr. Tatar from Harvard University.
Great to be with you. Great to talk.
And thank you for listening. Please mention to your social networks, online and off, that you enjoy the Social Network Show. If you're listening via iTunes or Stitcher.com, please check out our website also, thesocialnetworkshow.com. And if you like receiving email updates, you can subscribe from the blog page. So until we meet you here again, please have fun and be safe. Online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests, and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.